To destroy the documents or not to destroy the documents?
That is the question.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, the 24th of January. Coming up, for the first time, a Chinese bank tries to take over a U.S. bank. Also, the Pope has some tweeting advice for his Catholic parishioners.
Can't wait to hear what he has to say, Steve. But first, federal bankruptcy judges in Delaware are set to hear a couple of cases today about whether bankrupt subprime mortgage lenders can send thousands of boxes of documents to the shredder. It's a question that's causing a little concern.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth is with us from our New York studio with the latest. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
What exactly are these hearings about today?
Well, the hearings are about what should happen to more than 20,000 boxes of documents. Right now, they're all in storage, but that costs a lot. So the question is whether it's okay to get rid of them. Now, to be clear, these are two different cases, but the stories are very similar. Both companies are bankrupt, and the people in charge of managing the bankruptcies would like to get rid of the papers.
Why should we care then, Elisa, about a bunch of, dusty old papers sitting in some basement?
What we found out is that even in this day and age, physical papers can be very important. I talked to Tom LaMalfa this morning. He's a mortgage business analyst. This is how he put it.
Certainly the note and the mortgage are the most important two documents.
All those cases we've been hearing about lately of wrongful foreclosures and the like come back to keeping track of who owns the property and the loan, which is why those papers are important. So here's LaMalfa again.
What you need to do is be able to trace the movement and the assignment of the note from one investor to another.
So the question is whether there are any valuable documents in all those boxes or if they really are, as you said, just dusty old papers that can be destroyed safely.
All right. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reporting for us from New York. Elisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, as we said, that case Elisa was talking about is being heard in a courtroom in Delaware, just like a lot of big national business cases. Why is that? Well, let's find out now from the head of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. Charles Elson joins us this morning from Newark. Good morning.
Good morning.
So according to the state of Delaware's website, there are more than 850,000 business entities that have their legal home in Delaware, including more than half of all publicly traded U.S. companies. What's that all about?
Originally, most companies were incorporated in the state of New York. And around 1880, 1890, New York law changed and made it less hospitable for large companies to be there, and they moved across the river to New Jersey. And New Jersey law changed. Delaware was the next state over. And all that Delaware had was a law that simply was the old New York law, but they didn't change it.
And what is it about that law, Charles Elson, that companies like so much?
Well, it was just a very smart way of ordering relationships between investors, management, and boards of directors, and disputes would be resolved in an effective manner. But that really isn't the reason people are here today. We developed in this state a court system to resolve disputes involving that law, and the judges in that court became particularly good at resolving these disputes. And as a result, the court itself became really the reason to incorporate here as opposed to the law itself.
Are there other states that are vying to take over as the place where companies want to incorporate?
Oh, yeah. Nevada, North Dakota, for instance, have tried, but they haven't been successful. And I think it has to do, again, with this judiciary. It's considered neutral. The state itself has no business other than the effective regulation of corporations. So it's important to the state to maintain that franchise and maintain the view in the investor community that it is balanced in its approach.
What does it mean for Delaware's economy to have all these companies incorporating in the state?
About 27% of our direct revenue, tax revenue, comes from the corporations. Another significant amount comes from unclaimed dividends and whatnot. And then there's a lot of income tax that comes in from those businesses that are involved in corporate regulation. So it's very significant to the state. And that's why the state is so insistent on getting it right.
Charles Elson, head of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Very good to be with you.
All right, so you probably agree that talking on your cell phone or texting while driving is dangerous. Yes. Well, sadly, even though distracted driving kills more than 5,400 people every year, not everyone has gotten that message. So the Department of Transportation is holding talks this week and may ask car makers to help curb the urge to talk or text and drive. From Station WNYC, Alex Goldmark has more.
Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood is normally mild-mannered, but he does have a pet issue.
We've been on a rampage against distracted driving for nearly 2 years.
And he's taking that energy to Detroit tomorrow, where he'll meet with the CEOs of Ford and Chrysler. In a press conference last week, LaHood said he'd already talked with a handful of other car makers.
My meetings with the car manufacturers have given them a lot of opportunity to think about how they can be helpful to us.
One way is advertising. He thanked Subaru for a commercial that discourages teens from talking and driving. But he'll likely bring up some other ways to help, all voluntary, of course. John Ulyeski of the National Safety Council knows what he'd bring up, eliminating technological incentives to talk.
Automakers are developing products that automate the calling process. They make it easier to dial a phone. Some of them even have voice-to-text kind of systems.
But asking car makers to drop these features that attract new buyers will be a tough sell. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, January 24th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now let's get to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. The ripples of Chinese President Hu Jintao's visit to the U.S. are still being felt. The Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, or ICBC, is launching the first Chinese takeover of a bank inside the U.S. That is, if the deal's approved. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Chinese offshore oil company Sinuk's bid for U.S. oil giant Unocal failed. Chinese appliance maker Haiyar's attempt to purchase Maytag, ditto. So what are the chances ICBC's bid for a little-known U.S. retail bank will crash and burn, too?
Given the spectacle of failed acquisition attempts in the U.S. by Chinese firms in the past, it's pretty unlikely that ICBC would have taken this move without at least a wink and a nod from bank regulators.
That's Will Hess with economic advisory firm China Analytics. ICBC is the world's largest bank. It wants to buy 80% of the U.S. division of the Bank of East Asia. Never heard of it? That's exactly why ICBC may stand a chance with Congress as it seeks the Fed's approval. If the Fed says yes, the $140 million deal will give ICBC 10 branches in California and 3 in New York. It'll also mean a much-needed buyer for a bank that's been drowning in its own cesspool of subprime mortgages. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
From China to Ireland, that country has been on the brink of defaulting on its debt, and now those same economic problems are wreaking havoc inside the Irish Parliament. Yesterday, the country's Green Party leaders withdrew their support from the ruling party and called for a new election. Reporter Louise Williams is in Dublin for us this morning. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
Is this going to threaten the big bailout, the $100 billion bailout of Ireland that Europe granted last year?
That really is the big question. It's one of the conditions in order to access this money is to pass this finance bill. Now, Fianna Fáil, who's in government, say, oh, we need to take our time with this. And of course, they're being accused of, you know, dragging their feet. Labour, in the opposition party, they're saying this needs to be passed by Friday. We're going to have 3 all-night sessions in order to pass the finance bill. Then we need to hold elections as early as February 18th. Elections are currently scheduled for the 11th of March. This afternoon, we'll learn more about the schedule for passing the finance bill.
Louise, what does this mean for the global economy and for our listeners here in America? How's this going to affect them?
Ireland is a flashpoint for global concerns about the stability of the euro. And, you know, these concerns have also been expressed about Portugal, about Spain and about Greece. Now, the lack of stability in Ireland means a huge uneasiness for all of the 17 countries in the eurozone. A lack of confidence in Ireland now is going to undermine the euro. And a lack of a strong fiscal policy that's being seen to work for the euro is going to undermine the effectiveness of the euro in creating a strong currency for Europe.
Reporter Louise Williams in Dublin. Thank you, Louise.
Thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow is Robert Burns Night in Scotland. You ever heard of that, Steve?
Never heard of it.
Neither had I. Well, it's a holiday when the Scots like to enjoy the country's national dish, haggis.
Ah.
Of course, the U.S. bans the import of authentic Scottish haggis. So this week, in honor of Robert Burns Night, the Scots have invited American officials to see what they're missing. Joining us now from a farm just outside Edinburgh, Scotland, is Joe McSween of McSween Haggis. Thanks for joining us.
That's all right. Good to speak to you.
Well, let me first ask you, what is haggis for people who have not had the pleasure?
Yeah, and there's lots of you not getting the pleasure over there. It's made from minced lamb and beef, oatmeal, onion, seasoning, and spices.
Is that that's the whole story? Are you giving us the whole story, Joe?
Well, if you want me to go into more detail, it's made from what Scots call the pluck, which is heart, liver, and lungs.
There we go. That's what I was asking about. So why don't Americans like it?
Americans do like it, in my experience. As in American consumers, I find that when they come to food shows or we meet them at tastings, tasting haggis is like on the list of top things they have to do when they're over here. And they have some trepidation, then they eat it and they go, do you know what? That's really good. You know, what's all the fuss about?
Haggis is banned in the United States. It can't be imported from Scotland. What's that all about?
I think because haggis has a lot of myth and mystique around it, I think if in doubt, well, let's ban it.
You think we'll finally see the ban overturned?
I hope so. There's a huge number of American consumers I think would really enjoy a lovely foodstuff that's nutritious, it's full of fiber and iron, and enjoy it as often as we do.
Joe McSween of McSween Haggis, joining us from near Edinburgh, Scotland. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. Happy Burns Night tomorrow.
To the Vatican now, Steve, where Pope Benedict had a message today for those spreading the gospel online through social networks. It's not all about popularity and how many likes you get.
Yeah.
He told his fellow Catholics to take on a Christian-style presence online, one that is respectful and discreet. But hopefully, unlike at the actual Vatican, visitors to the church's Facebook page will still be able to write on the wall.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, January 24th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles and tweeting at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. My Twitter handle is at Jeremy Hobson. Also, for the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org.
A couple of big events in Washington this week. Tomorrow night, the president will give his State of the Union address. And during the day, the Fed will kick off a two-day meeting as well. But can you guess which one economists will be paying more attention to?
I can, Steve, and let's get the details now firsthand from one of those economists, Paul Dales. He's with Capital Economics in Toronto, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what is it that really has you interested in what the Fed's going to be doing?
Well, the interest really is whether the signs of a better economic environment prompt the Fed to alter its policy and buy fewer Treasury securities than it has pledged to do, which would therefore remove some support from the economy. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's too soon. The economic recovery is looking a bit better, but the Fed really needs to see more for it to withdraw its policy stimulus.
And the policy stimulus you're talking about is the $600 billion plan to buy up government bonds and really throw some more cash into the economy. How much do you think that matters outside of the United States? Do you think world leaders are going to be watching to see what the Fed does?
I think there will be, yes. There was quite a bit of an uproar when the Fed started this policy because it is seen to be pushing down the dollar, which therefore pushes up the exchange rate of other nations. So there is some concern there. And that might, further issues about this might prompt some governments to take measures to maybe reduce their own exchange rate, which obviously has implications around the world for every nation.
All right, Paul Dales, economist at Capital Economics. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
First, the government bailed out General Motors. Then Uncle Sam put taxpayer money into GMAC, the automaker's financing arm, to keep it from going under. Without the help, GMAC would have gone belly up, and its minority owners, GM, and other investors led by the private equity giant Cerberus would have lost everything. With the help, those same investors come out at least a little better, not losing the entire investment. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan is with us now to explain this change of fortune. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
So what kind of money are we talking about here?
We're talking about somewhere between $2.5 and $3.5 billion involving these guys' investment in GMAC, now known as Ally.
Are they going to recoup any of this money, Alan?
Absolutely. Sooner or later, they'll sell their piece of GMAC in public offering, and they'll still be down, but they'll be down a lot less than they would have been if GMAC had gone bankrupt.
Why'd the federal government become so concerned with GMAC in the first place? I mean, it let Lehman fail, right? Why not GMAC?
What happened with GMAC is GMAC finances 75% of the loans that vehicle dealers take to buy vehicles from GM. So if GMAC went out of business, there wouldn't be anybody to do this financing, because this financing is very sophisticated and not many organizations do it. So the government was afraid that 75% of GM's vehicle sales would disappear, and so would GM, and they were trying to save GM, so they saved GMAC as part of saving GM.
What lesson, Alan, do you think we can take away from all of this?
The difference between the way these big people, GM and Cerberus's investors, were treated and the way regular people were treated. GM and Cerberus are down, but they at least got something. If it had been a regular person in a similar circumstance, he would have been wiped out without a second thought.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan with us this morning. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome, Steve.
And finally, Jeremy Hobson, over the last few months, we've learned airlines haven't been doing as badly as they did during the recession. Do you know
right.
why? You know why. It's the fees.
All those fees.
It's the fees.
Yeah.
So we're talking, you know, $8 for a snack on board, or maybe the $25 bag fee.
Yep.
All these fees that they tack on, right? George Hobica of airfarewatchdog.com has a list of possible new airline fees for 2011. Give me some ideas, Jeremy. Come on.
Let's see. A charge to go through the airline, the airplane door.
Yeah, I don't know.
Putting your seat back, I don't know. What did he find?
Well, some of his ideas include a carry-on bag fee, perhaps. I think at least one airline's already doing that.
Yeah.
Maybe an infant fee to hold baby on your lap. All right, you got to pay for the baby to be on your lap.
What are you supposed
there.
To do if you don't want to pay the fee? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. I'm thinking this new fee, though, could be, and this is ingenious. I hope they give me, like, proceeds, right? The tray table fee, Jeremy. So what happens is the thing stays locked in the upright position. You can't loosen it, right, to bring it down until you swipe your credit card.
See, but that could also be a deposit. So when you put it back up, you get the money back on your card.
I don't think.
Then they wouldn't make any money on it.
Hey, we want to know what you think. What kind of fees do you think the airlines need or will require in the year 2011? Go to our website. You can vote and share your thoughts with us, too, at marketplace.org.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.